Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain of Angus.
Welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. This is episode number 101. I'm Paul Spain.
I'm Dave Baxter.
And I'm Bill Bennett.
Welcome along, guys. Good to have you here.
Hi, Paul.
Thank you.
Dave, this is your first time as a special guest on the NZ Tech Podcast. Thanks for joining us.
It is. Thanks. This is my first kind of talk about tech stuff.
Good.
It's all new.
What do you usually talk about?
I usually have to just talk about myself.
All good. Oh well, we might squeeze that in now. For those who don't know the name Dave Baxter, they may well know you as Avalanche City, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Avalanche City is like my band project thing, and I wrote a song called Love, Love, Love one time, and everybody now knows me as the Love, Love, Love guy, I think.
Oh, that's lovely.
Mr. Love.
Could be a movie about that. All sorts of angles on this, I'm sure. But tonight it's all about the tech stuff, so we'll jump in. Now, lots kind of going on in the tech world, as there always is. First up this week, Apple released their new iMac. Now, you're a bit of a Mac user, aren't you, Dave?
I am, yeah.
What do you think? There's this new iMac. It's nice, slim sides and so on. What stands out for you in terms of, you know, what do you need when you're using a Mac? Is it about speed? Or does it need to be portable because you're taking it on the road to do your recording?
The thing about that one, I've actually looked at that one, and the thing that really gets me about that is every time Apple release something new, they take something away that's actually really good. Like for this one, I think they took away the FireWire 800 port, and did they leave the CD drive in, or did they take that?
The CD DVD drive is gone.
Exactly.
Never to be seen again.
It's so annoying.
And I also read that it's impossible to upgrade the upgrade RAM without taking it back to the factory.
No, really.
So in the there's two models. There's a 21.5 inch model, and that one is, you know, according to the guys that repair and maintain these things, they're saying, look, this is just a nightmare. Yeah. They give it, I think, a 3 out of 10 for its sort of repairability and so on. The 27 inch model, which isn't available yet, they're going to be available in the next 2 to 3 weeks. That actually has a nice piece that you can, you know, take off and upgrade the RAM. For the lower end, the lower cost models, there's no such option. So yeah, that's a bit of a shame. I mean, it's the usual sort of thing. You know, there's always going to be a new iMac, a new phone, whatever coming through this time around. The usual thing about speed is there. It's a faster machine. One of the things that Apple have done in these new machines and with some of the new iMacs, is they've got what they're calling the fusion drive, and we've heard this term, we've heard the hybrid drive term before from other vendors. In fact, I think Microsoft introduced that concept probably back with Windows Vista, maybe 6 years ago. Certainly, quite a way back. This is a little bit different, but basically, it's a combination of an SSD or a flash drive and a hard drive. So you sort of get the benefits of both, the hard drive giving you large amount of storage, the SSD drive giving you that really fast speed, so quick boot ups and so on, which I think is definitely a good addition.
But the bit that's interesting about that is it decides what to put on which part of the drive, which is just brilliant. I mean, I've got my Windows PC set up with an SSD and a hard drive for data, and it's a bit of a pain in the arse knowing which bit, you know, should go where and so on. This, you know, the fact that it does that for you intelligently, it just takes a bit more of the pain out of computing.
Yeah, it does. I mean, we did see that with the hybrid drives that you can, you know, just buy for a standard machine. The difference with those is I think they've traditionally got only a four gigs worth of the, you know, the sort of SSD or flash storage in them. Whereas with Apple's drive, you're talking 128. Gigs of fast flash storage, say a terabyte of normal storage.
Which is what you want.
That's good.
And I think that's a really good approach. That's a really useful approach. So I hope we'll see this from other vendors come across other machines. I mean, we are seeing it to some degree. I know, for instance, Lenovo's current sort of ThinkPad, I think it's the T, the T430 model, you can buy in a similar type of configuration, but you know, I don't think it handles it. You know, does that intelligent sort of handling of it. The HP Spectre XT that I'm using is just pure flash storage, so this has got 256 gigs, you know, which is a good way to go as well. I don't have to think about any sort of slow storage; it's all fast. But having that sort of balance where it handles it for you, you get the best of both worlds is great.
Yeah, that is a good idea.
So, Dave, in terms of what do you use at the moment for your recording work?
Well, I actually have a Mac Mini in my studio. It's one of the older ones, and I'm totally going to need to upgrade for the next album. But I was thinking about an iMac, but the CD drive, man, it just you just need that. You need it to like burn CDs or burn DVDs for people. And if it's a recording studio, then you need to like burn something to give to like mastering or anything like that, you know.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, as we see things disappear out of products to sort of suit, I guess, a mainstream audience, you know, reduced size, lower manufacturing costs, etc., you know, we'll keep seeing this sort of stuff happen, but there's usually a workaround. And you know, in this case, you can buy, you know, just a separate drive to hook in, I think it's $120, so yeah. You know, it's not necessarily as, you know, as annoying, although if you're someone that uses it regularly, the hassle of having something external is genuine. And the fact that, you know, a lot of times, you know, we want to plug lots of things in, and it's just another port that gets you stuff as well, right?
And Intel's doing something just as annoying. Apparently the latest motherboards don't have sockets, or the motherboards that are about to be released don't have sockets, so you have to buy your processor, and it's not upgradable. And you know, a lot of the reason why you have a desktop is so that you can upgrade things. Now it's all soldered directly to the board.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, that's the nature of where things are going. Yeah. You buy something, and then when it's not quite what you want, you don't upgrade it. You just throw it out, put it on Trade Me, and you get the next one. And you know, it was probably, you know, I mean, Apple have probably been a champion of that in many ways over the, you know, over the years. And certainly, you know, we look at the iPhone, it's like that. And I remember going back to the early Macs, and I know you used to use one back in the 80s too, Bill.
Yeah.
And you know, Apple, you know, had a really beautifully designed, you know, computer, but you know, it was more challenging to get into than any of the other ones. I remember it was a Mac opener, I think, you could buy.
Special tool, yeah.
It was a special tool for getting into your Mac, and with that you could get in and upgrade
your $100 or something for a tool.
Your memory. So you know, they're very, very smart at controlling these things.
They are.
I mean, they're certainly not the only ones. I think, you know, most of the vendors have done it over the years. These days, things tend to be a lot more, you know, open to upgrading, and certainly on the Mac side, you know, we've still got the Mac Pro, which is, as you know, super upgradable, you know, very flexible. But the downside is the machine is, you know, 2 to 2.5 years old now, and so it's not really current with the rest of the the rest of the models, and we're sort of hanging out for supposedly a new model in 2013. So
it's still a ridiculous price.
Very, very pricey compared to everything else in the market. It's true. So, and it is strange that Apple have left it so long, but have, you know, really suggested that they will be bringing a new one out next year.
I just think that's it's a tiny part of their market share. You know, like is the towers. Like,
well, it is, and the large majority of Apple's profits come from selling the iPhone and the iPad.
Yeah,
and now really the you know, what we're seeing from the iMac is it's actually a pretty powerful machine. Mm. You know, quad core CPU, you know, lots of RAM and disk and so on. So yeah, pretty powerful overall, and for most sort of production and music and graphics type requirements, then you know, an iMac is actually pretty capable.
Yeah.
So jumping into to other topics now, we did mention previously around the Samsung Galaxy Note and Note 2, which is we've been waiting to come out in New Zealand. Of course, there was the sort of Australia/New Zealand launch that took place in Sydney a couple of weeks or so back. Tonight, actually, well, this week, we've got the New Zealand availability announcement. Now, you guys had a little bit of a play around with the Note 2, Dave. This was your sort of first chance to play with it.
Yeah.
As an iPhone 4 or 4S user, what's your impression on the Note 2?
Well, the Note 2 is actually, I really like it. I mean, the color on it isn't actually as great as I was kind of hoping. But the size of it is great. I mean, I do a lot of my like day-to-day stuff on my iPhone, just because you were saying before that it's always there. You know, you're sitting down, so you want to look at a web page, so you look at it on your iPhone. But the iPhone screen is just like, it's actually unusably small sometimes, like for web pages. So this is actually like a great in between a tablet and a phone. But when I was pretending to use it as a phone before, I did feel like I was holding up an iPad to my face. I did feel a little bit ridiculous.
Yeah, it is pretty big. But I mean, I think you kind of get used to it. And there seem to be a bunch of people that are you know, jumping on board with it. I think we were mentioning last week, it's up to over 5 million sold now, you know, internationally ahead of the New Zealand launch. It's been available, I think, in the US now for about 2 months.
And it seems that there's just about every size combination you can imagine, from the small screens on the smaller smartphones right up to the sort of mega displays. Just about every possible combination of screen diagonal widths measured in inches is now catered for, and that's just one of those sizes.
That's true. This actually does fit comfortably in my pocket. Yep. But my wife was saying before, we looked at the normal Samsung, whatever it is, Galaxy S3 today, and she'd never use it because it would never fit in a girl's pocket.
A lot of girls are using using the Galaxy S3, right? It's not just popular with guys.
Yeah. Mm. Well, the funny thing about that Samsung is it's about the size of those very first, I don't know, probably 15 years ago, portable computers, things like Pocket and so on. Do you remember those models? They were about that size, but they had a keyboard on them and a tiny screen. And it's about that size.
The old Pocket PCs were actually pretty large, weren't they? Yeah. Not much battery life. You didn't get sort of much for your money, but in those days, just having something, a portable piece of technology to take with you was pretty handy.
But this one, it would fit in a jacket pocket, perhaps. Maybe not in a shirt pocket.
Not in a shirt pocket, no. You could put it in your shirt pocket and let everyone else know you've got a Samsung phone.
Yeah, you absolutely would. Well, I have the constant challenge because I'm usually juggling a few phones in terms of reviewing and so on, and the shirt I'm wearing today is not good when I want to carry, you know, an extra phone in each pocket because the pockets are so small. They're half the phone sort of sticking out, and with that one, I don't even know if it would fit in with the Note 2. But
so it's like that sort of Mae West thing, isn't it? About, are you happy to see me? Or is that a Samsung in your pocket?
Yeah. Now, in other phone news, something if size does matter, there is a but you're wanting something a little bit on the more shrunk side. An iPhone 5 size new Windows phone. We've got the HTC. Windows Phone 8S. Now, we had the announcement, we had a little bit of a play with this, and we mentioned it previously, that was coming out, I think, end of this week from Telecom. But there was a little surprise communication I received from Vodafone on Friday, and they've actually launched it ahead of Telecom, and they're doing it at 10% less. So a pretty nice little smartphone, four-inch screen, not the same definition as the iPhone. This is the same as some of the last generation of Windows smartphones, but the HTC Windows Phone 8S, $449 from Vodafone, with 4 gigs of storage and micro SD, so you can drop in another 32 gigs if you want to, which costs next to nothing.
So it looks like HTC is making a bid for the bargain area of the smartphone market.
Well, they seem to be sort of playing across the board at the high end, sort of down to that lower end. But it does seem to vary in each market what the telco carriers are bringing in, because we just heard in the last 2 or 3 days that in the US, where the 8S had gone through sort of certification and so on to come into the market, that no one had actually picked it up. They were picking up the higher end 8X from HTC. So, whereas here in New Zealand at the moment, we've got the 8S. We're hearing that the 8X, which is their high end one, will be coming into the market soon too. But nothing confirmed about who and when exactly on that one. So, it's good to see a good variety, and this keeps the market competitive, and it's really good value for an absolutely latest generation smartphone, dual core 1 gigahertz processor, 5 megapixel camera. Not top end, but good for, you know, everyday, you know, out shots and on a you know, daytime, those, that sort of lower cost camera or lower end camera, not really so useful for night shots.
It's a fleet phone for probably small to medium business, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think in that sort of situation it'll work well, and you know, someone wanting to buy a smartphone that doesn't have $1,000 to spend, or doesn't want to commit to a $80 a month type plan. Like someone wants to go on one of those prepaid plans that you can pick up or you can subscribe to for, say, $19 a month. That's probably quite a good fit.
It's Corolla. Corolla of the phone business.
Yeah, exactly. Now, another bit of news that we sort of heard about over the weekend was what was going on with Syria there and their internet being cut for a number of days. Now, word is this is all back online, and there's, I guess, as we would expect, all the pointers are pointing at the government sort of, cutting off the internet and mobile services and so on to stop some of the uprising that's going on there. It seems like this is just becoming a common thing, particularly around in the Middle East. With the various challenges to government that have been going on recently. Is there going to be any way to stop this, or is this just going to become the norm now? Whenever a government's sort of concerned about,
I think your government's in trouble if they turn the phones off.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But I think there are probably plenty of other signs of that.
Yeah.
In Syria, probably. Over the last few months, there's enough people, dying and fighting for their lives. It's a sad state of affairs,
I don't know whether cutting off the internet will actually do a huge amount. I mean, these people, although we are talking about In Syria, typically in Afghanistan and stuff like that, they typically communicate word, mouth to ears and stuff like that, just face to face kind of thing.
But yeah, we're relying more and more on technology, and in some parts of the world they're bringing in mobile communications ahead of there being landlines. Parts of China.
I think there's something else going on with this though, and that is it could also be about the message getting out to the rest of the world, and that's what they don't want. So if you're going to do something truly evil as a government, like maybe a massacre or something,
that's true.
You'd switch everything off first before you
turn off the lights.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah.
Do it in the dark
before you do it.
Oh,
yeah.
So that's actually a really flip side to it.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's a pretty horrid thought, really. But the reality is, it's so easy now to take an image and to upload it to Twitter or to Facebook, or to take some footage and to put it on YouTube, or even put it up live. So by cutting those things off, it makes that sort of thing much harder. Of course, there's always ways around it with satellite phones and the like, but that's not going to be accessible in the same way that we're now seeing. Non-smartphones, will probably disappear over the next 5 years. Everybody, if they've got a phone, it's going to be a smartphone of some sort. Yeah. You're going to be able to take that content and push it online. So, in some ways, this is something we're likely to see a lot more of, unless the UN or someone can crack down on it, which it's probably impossible to crack down on.
To be honest, though, those kind of countries don't really listen a lot to the UN anyway, do they?
That's true.
And also, what they're doing is a lot of the protests and all those kind of things, like the big movements, all do coordinate through Facebook and through social media. So what they're doing is, I guess, going, let's have 2 days of no protests and see what we can do.
And it tends to come when there is a real uprising going on. So my question is there some other technology that could come in at a low cost that, maybe there's some sort of peer-to-peer communication or people setting up their own connection points to the internet that will buy
FIDO net or something.
Something that maybe bypass the government's stranglehold on internet connections into the country. Yeah, so
it's called Wi-Fi.
Yeah, well, I guess that can be a part of the picture. Yeah. Maybe that sort of thing tied into satellite connections and the like.
Well, we can lose sight of this in New Zealand because we're so far from anyone else. But wireless doesn't stop at the border, so a country like Syria would have there'd be quite a long stretch of the country around the border which is within reach of towers and so on. So it's not.
That's true, I guess. Yeah, and when you're in those certain places, but there'll be other places where you're nowhere near something else. So, you know, I think as we see the continual, you know, increased accessibility to satellite type internet, and there are obviously fixed satellite internet connections that are you know, that are broadly available. You know, farmers use them, you know, and they're often used in rural circumstances here in New Zealand, the same in US and Australia and various other markets. So, you know, as those things become more commonplace, you know, into the mix as well, I guess that will bypass and limit the stranglehold that the government can put on things.
And people can still take pictures on their cameras, their phone cameras, and load them up later on anyway, so...
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, that's true. So yeah, I guess there's really is those two sides of it, sort of stopping getting word out internationally as well as sort of stopping the communications amongst you know, those who are really wanting to stir things up. All right, now Microsoft with their Surface. Now, we've talked about this on the podcast before. The initial Microsoft Surface tablet that came out, the Surface for Windows RT, still not available in New Zealand. Microsoft New Zealand, you know, as seems to be the way with all these multinationals now, you know, Apple's regional branches have similar sort of thing. They don't have visibility on what's going on and when it's going to be available from what we can tell. So we're waiting, but amid that we've had the announcement for the Surface Pro tablet, which is a much more powerful device that runs full-blown Windows 8. It's got an Intel Core i5 processor, and looks like the sort of device that could be a replacement for you know, for laptops and PCs for people, because it's pretty grunty you know, grunty piece of hardware. And the price starts at $899 for one of those with...
$899 US,
yeah, good point. With 64 gigs worth of storage, or $999 US with 128 gigs worth of storage, which is not a terrible increase in price for an extra 64 gigs worth of SSD storage.
It's about the price of an Ultrabook.
Yeah. That's without the... without one of their keyboards, so you've got to then pick a keyboard.
Okay,
and,
I'm going to tell you something now. The keyboard will be given away as part of the deal, perhaps after 6 months. You know, 6 months in, you'll get a keyboard when you buy one as part of the price. Maybe not for the first 6 months.
They keep that as a premium thing, and then you think they'll just drop it in there.
I'll have a bet with you about that.
All right, we can discuss the terms after we've finished recording on that one. So, I mean, it's interesting to see that pricing coming through. It's, you know, as you say, it's sort of the price that we see for, you know, Ultrabooks today. Most of the, I mean, obviously there's a difference in terms of size. It's got a 10.6-inch screen. It's designed to be a pretty portable device. It's coming in under a kilo, so, you know, 900 and something grams. Which is pretty impressive for the sort of power that you'd be lugging around with that. So I'm really interested to see this and to try it out and just see, you know, how it fits. I like the Surface that's out today, but there are some limitations of that, and it's always a trade-off. How much power do you want versus how portable, small and light do you want the device to be?
This is the post-PC PC. And the interesting thing that I've noticed, though, is there's been a lot of whinging about the price. I've noticed that online too, particularly overseas, people complaining about the price. I don't think it's that high.
No, I think there's a segment that wants everything to do with Microsoft to be at a lower price than whatever Apple are doing. And it depends whether you compare it with a MacBook Air, which is in some ways a relevant consideration, or whether you compare it with an iPad, which is also a relevant consideration. I mean, the Surface is a device that sort of sits between these two. It'll do what a traditional touch tablet will do, but it will also run, you know, Photoshop, you know, audio recording software. You can, you know, there's a very powerful system. You can run a large high definition screen on it as well. Those comparisons are fair, but I think they had to price accordingly based on what it would cost, and, you know, somewhere they've got to, you know, they can't sell it below cost. Well, they could do anything they like, I suppose, but while they've still got the you know, the HPs and Samsungs who are selling Windows, you know, they've got to be a little bit cautious about stepping on too many toes, I imagine.
Yeah, I think we should look for stories with corporations buying large numbers of them to see if that's actually happening, because that's what we were expecting, you know, those tablets to go into corporations.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're also of interest to just people that want something to use that's really portable, and that's what I like about the Surface RT, is it is a really portable device that'll you know, do all the fun stuff, but let you do some work and so on if you want to as well. So, all right, so Surface 8 RT, now that comes out in January. We're thinking probably second half of January in the US, and maybe this will be available in New Zealand. Not sure yet. I'm in the middle of writing a review actually on the Surface for RT that's going to be in next month's PC World. If anyone wants to find out a little bit more about that from a local perspective, I'll be doing a bit of a write up and getting a little bit more in depth with some of those features. Now, Bill, you've written an interesting post up on your site about a small and insignificant announcement that happened over the last few days. Fill us in on that. What are your thoughts? You went into a fair bit of detail on your blog at billbennett.co.nz, but give us a sort of a mini wrap on that.
Okay, the guts of it is this. The Commerce Commission's ruled on how much Chorus can charge for ISPs to get access to the copper network.
Right, so to get an ADSL connection at home or... Yep. Or any of that sort of stuff. Yeah,
they've cut the price that ISPs have to pay to Chorus. I mean, we have to keep in perspective that Chorus only wholesales to ISPs. I mean, it's not the price that the consumer pays; it's the price that the ISP pays to get onto the network via Chorus. And it's been cut. It's been cut. Well, it hasn't been cut. It's a proposal. It's a proposed price, and it's. It's caused much gnashing of teeth at both ends, because Chorus thinks it's way too much and they're saying it's going to cost them $160 million and it ruins their business model.
And there's been quite a drop in their share price too.
Yeah, a 14% drop in the share price, which I don't think anyone anticipated it would be that major. Whereas the ISPs are saying, well, it's not really quite enough, but yeah, we'll take this one, thank you very much, because... And the issue here is really about whether or not the government needs to subsidise fibre or perhaps help fibre by making copper more expensive. And that's the argument that's going on at the moment. The argument being that copper is actually such a good deal that people won't want to upgrade to fibre unless either fibre is subsidised or the copper is priced artificially high. And it's a debate no one can win, because we don't get fibre to most of the suburbs for another 4 or 5 years. Some of us it'll be 7 or 8 years even. And so in the meantime, we'll be paying over the odds for the old network, which, you know, I'd say it's really something neither side can really win. There's going to be tears before bedtime on this one. But the thing that bothers me, and the thing that's quite, you know, upsetting people that I wrote on my site, is that if the government intervenes to reprice copper because they feel that that's interfering with fibre's chances of taking off, are they then going to intervene later on to make mobile broadband more expensive? Because the evidence in the rest of the world is that where people have a choice between mobile broadband and fibre, they're buying mobile, not fibre, or at least significantly more people are buying wireless
connections, internet connections, yeah,
than was previously expected, and sufficient and significantly fewer people are buying fibre than.
Yeah, it's quite interesting to see, isn't it? There seems to be there's a chasm between the cost of mobile broadband. You know, if you get a 3G connection, you think I'm going to use this for at home to watch my videos and do everything on. I mean, you know, you're for a reasonable amount of money, you're only going to get you know, say five gigs worth of data, whereas we're now seeing that, you know, fixed line connections, be it ADSL or or a fiber connection, you know, some of them are offering unlimited, but you know, quite typically in the 100 plus gigs worth of data, which is, there's a huge difference. Do you think that side of it's going to come together and we're going to see
because the
costs
thing
come down for wireless?
No, I don't think so, because I think the issue here is that 5 gigs is a lot when you've got a screen that's, you know, a few inches big.
Yep, on a smartphone. Yeah, it's not so useful for watching video streaming on your TV and so on.
No, it's not,
is it?
But that you can get that by other means. You can get that data over an ASDL thing, you know, quite happily. And you're quite right. If you're going to be watching a lot of high-resolution video, then you're going to want fibre to the home. But like I say, that's not what's happening in Japan. That's not what's happening in certain other countries where fiber networks are going in. People are turning their backs, because the things that the people in power haven't quite got their heads around yet is people are turning their backs on television. Young people today just do not watch television in the same.
I'll second that.
Yeah,
yeah.
In the same. I mean, my kids might watch 3 or 4 hours of television a week. I personally might watch 6 or 7 hours of television a week. I know people who watch 6 or 7 hours of television a day, you know, but they tend to be older and they tend to be the kind of people that won't be using fibre in that anyway. So there's actually a mismatch there. And my fear has always been with the UFB network is that we might be building a network for people that people don't actually want. And it's got little to do with whether it's $20 more than the copper network.
Yeah, I think over time that's not going to be too much of an issue. I think people are going to use more and more data.
I think
even people that don't use much, data today, will soon end up in a space where it's relevant. Yeah. You know, we'll see Sky TV and these other things. Even if you don't watch a lot, we'll see all of those things delivered over internet connections,
you're completely right. But what I think is, I think the demand isn't there today, and it's probably not going to be there for a little longer than those in power thought. And like I said, when people do want connectivity now, they want wireless. It's just what's happening. It's actually what people are voting. You know, when they vote with their own wallets, that's what they're buying. So there's. You know, as I say, this whole thing is going to end in tears one way or the other.
Yeah, it's a fascinating space to watch. I think and it's good that we're seeing competition and innovation, you know, as in other areas. So the wireless guys are, obviously, they're going to keep competing, right? We're going to see faster and faster speeds. We don't have 4G here in New Zealand yet, so our mobile broadband speeds aren't super fast, but in some cases they're faster than what you can get in your home, with an ADSL connection. But obviously limited in caps,
and it's quite bursty as well when it's used. So,
I think we'll certainly keep talking about this one and watching and seeing how it progresses. In the immediate, there's no immediate sort of impact on prices for consumers or businesses.
No, it's still a year out before anything happens. Anyway, there's another really weird aspect to this I just want to mention though, and that's this. It's a national government, a right-wing government, that wants to intervene in the market, where most of the rhetoric from the government is about not intervening in markets. And it's kind of weird, because you've got the Labour opposition is almost making the noise about the government shouldn't be intervening in this market. So you've actually got the sort of the politics of broadband in New Zealand a bit topsy-turvy.
Yeah, I mean, I guess whatever the ruling party does, the other party's probably going to poo-poo it, right?
Yeah, so, well, look at Australia and the NBN.
There's a whole level of that.
And, yeah, there is.
Yeah, within the NBN in Australia, which is their equivalent of the ultra-fast broadband, here, it's...
It's a political nightmare in Australia. It's a train wreck.
Yeah. All right, now moving on to other topics. Now, QuickFlix have had a fair bit of coverage over the past couple of weeks. Of course, we had Patty on the podcast 2 weeks ago, and then there was all of the stuff that sort of hit the news with a couple of their key execs in Australia leaving, and they've since, I think, had to lay off about 30% of their workforce. But in the meantime, they seem to be working away with some of the launching some new products. So we've just heard confirmation on a couple of things that we had heard about from them previously. So the first of those is a little stick from Dish TV, which basically it looks a little bit like a USB stick, but on one end it's got an HDMI connection, and what it is a stick that goes into your TV and gives you sort of smart TV type capabilities for a standard TV. And one of the apps that it comes with is a Quick Flix app. So for people that are wanting to stream content and you don't have any other way of doing it, you don't want to do it through your computer and so on, that'll give you that capability. It's actually got Android on the stick. So quite a cool proposition. I think it's $129 locally here in New Zealand, and available through quite a few retailers and online as well. So we'll be having a look at one of those over the next few days, and we'll report back on just how useful it is. I can't imagine it's super powerful being such a tiny little device, and I think it's probably USB powered as well to keep it running. So we'll be having a look at what the practicalities are
and where it might be useful.
How's it going to
draw power from a TV?
A lot of TVs have a USB port on them as well, so it may just be able to pull it from that. I think that's probably how it happens, but we'll have a look and try it out and report back on that one. Now, the other thing is that they've also, QuickFlix have announced a bit of a deal with Freeview here in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Now, have you seen anything on that one, Bill?
Yeah, I saw the story on stuff.co.nz. That looks quite interesting, and it's a little bit back to what we were just talking about earlier with fibre and so on, that there are other ways of getting TV signals and content to your to your home other than through the net. Freeview is not going very well, I think, judging by what I mean.
Is it not?
Well, it's not much of a buzz around the thing, is there?
Well, I think, I mean, Freeview, they've done pretty well in getting people off, traditional sort of analog TV, and with some of the Freeview recorders and so on, you've got capabilities that is quite similar to the MySky HDI type box, but obviously a lot of people just want to or need to have access to some of the other content that Sky has. So you've sort of got those two worlds to
get into. I hadn't turned my Freeview box on for more than a year, so
well, I guess there are a lot of ways of getting access to Freeview, though. Yeah. I mean, most TVs now, Freeview's just built in. If you're watching TV straight off your TV, then you're watching you're watching Freeview. I've got a TiVo box at home, one of the sort of semi freebies that Telecom were doing that we mentioned on the podcast earlier on in the year, and I also can get it through through Media Center computer. So there's a few different ways of utilizing that and being able to record the bits and pieces that you want, which is how I would tend to watch it rather than a whole lot of live TV.
We never watch live TV, but then we've got an old TV. Analog.
So what do you watch?
Mostly stuff online, like the TV on demand or something like that,
Okay.
Movies.
Yep. Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yep. Download the content.
If we're watching a movie, we don't even put it on our TV. The main reason being that we can't, because it's an analog TV. But I'll just bring down my big studio computer monitor and we watch it on that, and that's good.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of that. Like people at my age and in my generation tend to watch a lot of TV on laptops. Like a lot of my friends wouldn't even be bothered putting it onto their TV.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm probably unusual for someone of my generation that I'm probably more like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting to dive in and just have a look at exactly. How this is going to work with QuickFlix tying into Freeview, HD, and I mean that does use the internet there to, you know, to be hooked up. It's all, it's all part of it. It's not just a straight you know, everything coming down over the over a Freeview you know, over the broadcast type channels. So yeah, it's quite a unique offering as far as I'm aware. I haven't seen a whole lot about this type of thing happening in other markets. So it's good to see.
Although it might not get a lot of traction, it's so good to see something compete with Sky.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely need to keep that competition. Yep. Keep that competition true. Up.
Yeah,
And you know, I think it is one of the frustrations for a lot of people that we've got. This one player that has such a heavy stronghold on entertainment in New Zealand. Now the other one that is just hit is it's 50% owned by Sky, isn't it? The new option that's just come into the market, which is the Igloo prepaid TV offering. Now this one's sort of been coming for coming for some time.
Oh, it's been talked about for a year or so now. It's one of those things coming real soon now.
So Igloo have just launched into the market. The beginning of this week. So their offering is you buy their set top box, which is $199 New Zealand dollars, and you get access to, in general, the bulk of the Freeview type content that's available with an aerial, and it's only available in areas. From what I can tell, that can pick up the terrestrial high definition Freeview signal. So there are certainly some there are a lot of parts of the country that won't get it. But if you're in a major city that picks up Freeview HD, then you're good to go. And there's a bunch of channels like UK TV, Comedy Central, Food TV, Vibe, Kidzone, BBC Knowledge, and so on that basically will be available on that prepay type basis. And in addition to that, then you can get pay-per-view type sport. Now, one of the things that I guess defines the Igloo offering at the moment is it's prepay, but B, the content is in standard definition, which is something that we see with QuickFlix at the moment as well. Although what we're hearing is that's going to change from them. It definitely that helps sort of define it, I guess, as a lower end sort of product, because we're starting to see Sky TV over time will end up with more HD content, although the large majority of their content too is in standard definition.
Well, I have to say, I'm like Dave, I don't have a high definition television because I don't watch enough television to justify buying
exactly.
one. So standard definition suits me fine.
And what kind of prices are they saying about the Igloo? Yeah.
Okay, so for Igloo, basically you've got an ongoing fee, which I'm seeing here that it's $25 for 30 days worth of TV.
That's actually pretty good.
Yeah,
like I'd actually probably consider paying that.
Yeah, and I'd use it for sport, I think.
But that's on top though. Sports.
So
on top.
You've got pay per view for sports events.
Yeah, I'd use pay per view for sport.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
$15 per game.
Ooh.
Oh, go to the bloody game for that.
You go to the pub. To the pub and then you get a couple of beers for that.
$15 a bit. No, I think Eden Park. Well, it's $60-$70 to get in quite often.
Oh yeah.
So yes, I mean, there's definitely. I think there's going to be a bit of interesting debate, really, around Igloo and who's going to use it. But I guess that prepaid nature of it sort of points to a different market than the people that are traditional viewers of Sky that are quite happy to pay, $60, $70, $80, $90, whatever it is, dollars a month to have a subscription. This is certainly a lower cost way of getting access to a little bit more than the free content we have today. Now, they're also going to offer some services, I guess, along the lines of what we're used to with with QuickFlix, in that there'll be, you know, pay-per-view type content. So they've got a range of movies that are available for streaming at $6.99 a piece in terms of very new, you know, new release type stuff that's floating around on DVD and Blu-ray at the moment.
QuickFlix isn't the Netflix, like New Zealand Netflix version, is it?
Yeah,
it
is, yeah. It's kind of the competitor.
I remember looking at that, like, because we spend a lot of time in America. And we use Netflix over there, right? Because it's great. But when we heard about QuickFlix, we checked it out because we thought it was going to be amazing. But the problem was, the content was just appalling.
A small catalogue,
And they were all from the 80s or something like that, movies.
So that catalogue, we're now seeing that is starting to grow. You know, there's a few hundred TV programs on there. Okay. There's a bunch of movies and so on. But, I mean, even now when you look at Netflix itself, you can be disappointed because most of the new releases aren't on there. You'll pay a premium for those on a pay-per-view basis generally. So, I mean, I think it's just good that we're seeing more content options available in New Zealand. And, you know, for me, you know, if the choice is being able to rent a movie that can stream straight down and pay $6.99 for it, as opposed to walk down and rent a DVD, you know, as long as the quality's good and it streams instantly and so on, then that's the sort of thing that I would definitely consider.
And I'd definitely use that.
The
as
problem
well.
I always had with DVD rentals, and I must admit I don't rent them anymore, is that I would always probably forget to return them the next day, and I'd get stung with 2 days worth of fees. So your movie suddenly cost you $16.
I had problems with skipping or freezing on DVDs. Yeah, I had one movie scratched. That I hired out years ago. We hired out The Lion King just for a laugh, and Simba was just climbing up onto Pride Rock right at the very end, and then it stopped. No climax at the end of that movie.
And that's the issue actually I had with Blu-rays, and sort of once or twice a year we'll look at and sort of review what's happening in 3D TV or 3D projectors. We've just been looking at Panasonic's new AE8000, which is a stunning, absolutely awesome projector. But when we were doing our review last year, to do that, we rent out some Blu-ray discs. Now, this time I solved the issue just by buying some 3D Blu-ray discs, but I rented some last year, and I got exactly that. I was most of the way through a movie, I was quite enjoying it, and then as you got towards the end, it started, the disc must have been damaged in some way. And yeah, I just hadn't had that for years, so it was a bizarre experience to come across.
Though. Same thing happens with streaming.
The same thing does happen with streaming.
Very, very rarely, if you've got a good connection, especially if you've got UFB, or you've got a reliable connection, then, I mean, I think if you're using a good quality service, most the services now are pretty good. If you're streaming YouTube, YouTube's notorious for, for those sort of pauses and so on, particularly on. Some of the ISPs, like I know Telstra Clear have had issues, but we often see that those sort of delays. But if you're working through a good service, and I predominantly use Netflix through the hoops you have to jump through to use it here in New Zealand, and a pause, those sort of issues are very few and far between.
The one thing that I'd like to know is for those people who have surround sound, can you stream a movie with surround sound yet?
You can, but I think at the main. I'm not aware of any 3D movie streaming that's available.
Mm.
But I think 5.1 is okay. But getting access to 3D, isn't generally the norm. Yeah. But I think over time these things, these issues, they won't be issues anymore. It'll just be the norm that everything gets catered for. And bear in mind, if you're wanting to watch things in a nice high definition and so on, that is still an issue with the service and most of the other sort of local options out there such as QuickFlix. But it's certainly good to have some options, and as we've heard, those limitations are likely to disappear as things move ahead. Presuming QuickFlix manages to address some of the financial issues that they have in Australia and get themselves on track. But my pick would be, if they really run into difficulty, that someone else is going to come along and buy them or fund them or whatever. So, you know, I don't think these sort of services are going to go away, and they're just going to gain traction, just like Netflix has in the US and some of the other markets where it's been launched. All right, well, I think that really that covers most of our tech news. Now, Dave, we wanted to chat to you a little bit around how you've been using technology, you know, from a musician's point of view with Avalanche City. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your last album, how you recorded that, and where technology sort of you know, came into play.
Yeah, well, I guess for Avalanche City, a lot of it was the whole social media thing, because that plays a huge part in everything today, like breaking a band and everything. Like in terms of technology, everything's just become so much more readily available, and just the quality is so much better. I mean, the fact that like a guy can go into a hall with just a couple of microphones and a computer and record an album and mix it himself without a studio. I mean, I mixed,
which is what you did, right?
Yeah, this is what I did. Yeah, and I mean, I did. I mixed the. I didn't even have studio speakers or anything. I mixed it on my Sony stereo system that I've had since I was 15, and I still use it. Actually,
and this album did pretty well, right? You ended up sort of top of the charts with.
Well, it did pretty good. Yeah. And so I think that's where we're at with technology. Is like you can just kind of do whatever you want. You no longer have to have a $100,000 budget and go into a studio to record anything. It's just like if you've got a computer and if you've got a mate with a microphone, then you can probably do it yourself.
That's pretty cool. And but you're seeing this, you know, because I guess that's been the case for a number of years. I remember another muso who I know out of the UK, Daniel Bedingfield. He had you know, his first single, which ended up selling sort of, you know, I think the album sold, you know, millions sort of thing. You know, he'd done a similar thing, just sort of recording on his own his own stuff. But now that's moving into the whole video realm as well, right? Tell us a little bit about. You know, where the technology sort of merges into the production of music videos.
Well, actually, like a great thing about music videos is I've actually never done I've done 4 or 5 music videos now, but not one of them has been on your standard big huge camera that you usually think about when you think about large scale things. It was all done on Canon 5Ds or something like that.
Yeah, so on digital SLR type cameras.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of it. It doesn't even look like you're shooting a music video anymore. It just looks like you're taking photos. The latest one that I've done, Sunset, which was actually sort of towards the beginning of the year, that was quite a unique one, because I was over at the States at the time that we were talking about making the video. Found a director. But by the time we found a director and fleshed out a storyline and everything like that for the video, I had to come back to New Zealand. So what we did is I found a director in New Zealand to work with my director in the States, and we hooked up a Skype link, like a live Skype link.
Yeah.
And in the shooting studio, the director in the States was standing by live watching the shoot, and we'd fire him through the high-res footage to him, and he'd look at it and tell us to adjust some lighting, and then he'd fire that through to his animator, who was standing by somewhere else in America, who was making sure the green screen would key. So we had this team of people all kind of online together. It must have been like 3 a.m. over there, actually, thinking about it now.
Yeah. You weren't really thinking about that, were you?
so that's kind of where we're at now with technology, is we have like... all these people in different parts of the world working on a project together, and it doesn't really hinder it at all. In fact, in some ways, it speeds things up. And I've got another mate, Luke Thompson, who's just doing a video with a UK director who he met online through a UK website called Radar Music something.
And is that sort of a crowdsourcing or what sort of mechanism was that to make that hookup?
So that's a website that just puts directors in contact with musicians. So yeah, as a musician, I'll say, I've got this track, I've got $1,000 budget, or I've got $2,000 budget. This is the kind of video that I want. And he had pitches from about 5 different directors. So as an artist, especially in New Zealand, for me, if I was gonna do a video, I'd never really think about getting pitches from 5 different directors, because there's probably only 5 different directors in New Zealand anyway that will do it for that cheap. So it's kind of like it's an amazing thing. It's just like pulling all these people together around the world, and his project's going great. And I mean, he's never met the guy though.
Yeah, so it just shows how technology is making changes everywhere, and it's also disrupting industries. And I guess, yeah, this is, you know, one of the challenges for especially in New Zealand, where we're made up of lots of sort of small to medium businesses, is, you know, the nature of technology that's disrupting a lot of businesses. And I think, you know, it's important that you know, business owners and those, you know, across the country realize and understand, you know, the two sides of what technology is doing. Because on one side, it's creating lots of opportunities, and those who think strategically about how to leverage technology for their business can sort of, you know, take advantage and sort of, you know, ride the wave. But others will find that their business will go the way of Kodak, where the technology changes can end up, you know, crushing and destroying their business. So it's it's both a good and a bad time to be involved with things to do with technology, I suppose.
Yeah, cool. For my perspective, it's an exciting time to be an artist. Possibly not an exciting time to be a record label or you know, in the industry.
Yeah, but you get good support. What, you're with a record label locally?
I'm actually signed to Australia, Warner in Australia, but worldwide. As a New Zealand artist, if you're an artist inside of New Zealand, you don't actually really need a record label at all. You can kind of do it all yourself. But if you're thinking about going overseas, then you kind of need some money behind you, which is where the label comes in.
That's good. That's good. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm glad you've got them behind you. All right. Well, I think that's us for this week on the New Zealand Tech Podcast. Thanks everyone for listening in. Now, Dave, if they want to, if people want to keep in touch and or find a little bit more out about you, what's your website?
Website is avalanchecity.com. Currently, I'm actually about to release a free EP. Just as a little Christmas present
cool, those. I like Christmas presents.
Yeah, it's not a Christmas album, but it is a Christmas present. So that's just because I've had a pretty good time in the last year. So this is my thank you to everyone who supported Avalanche City. It's not an Avalanche City EP, but it's a Dave Baxter EP.
Okay.
Yeah. So
cool. And where do we find you? Also, you're on Twitter and so on as well.
Yeah, yeah. So if you just go to avalanchecity.com, there's a link to Facebook and Twitter, and I usually keep them updated.
Cool. Mm. Cool. Excellent. And Bill,
man around town.
You're easy to track down online too, aren't you?
Yeah. Bill Bennett NZ on Twitter, and BillBennett.co.nz. That's two N's and two T's. My parents just say that Bennett's like Guinness.
Well, two N's and two S's.
Yeah, well, yeah. The choke goes better in Ireland.
I bet it does. Now, actually, your blog's been pretty active lately. There's been a lot of good content. So, I mean, I encourage people to go there and either to follow you on Twitter or to have a little bit of a look at the blog, because you're good at sort of diving into some of the controversial subjects and stirring things up a little bit, Bill.
Yeah, it's still reporting though, but watch this space, because something exciting could be happening there early in the new year.
Good, yeah. Excellent. And as always, I'm on Twitter at Paul Spain, and my main blog is hosted at Geek Zone, which is techjungle.com. So keep a watch there, and a few other bits and pieces online, which you'll usually hear about via my Twitter feed. Doing a few bits with TV3 lately, so I'll be back on there again in a couple of weeks with a little tech segment on their brekkie show. But otherwise, you can track NZ Tech Podcast online. You can track us down online, nztechpodcast.com. We're on Facebook as well and on Twitter. Very easy to find in those places. So, hey, thanks everyone for listening in. See ya.